Hi Hadi, thank you for being with us. You're here today with several hats. As director of the IHE Delft Institute for Water Education, the president of the Global Network of Water Museums, the observer at the Netherlands National Committee for the Intergovernmental Hydrological Program of UNESCO, the IHP, and the Hydrology and Water Resources Program of the World Meteorological Organization. And finally, also as professor of water and climate at the Vrije University of Amsterdam. Please, can you tell us something about your background and when did you start to think that understanding the past can be relevant for today's challenges?
Hi, Matteo, I'm quite happy to be here. And actually, for somebody that's also working in climate change, the past is important, but in a different way than what we're discussing today. Climate change often looks at the long time series. Those are the geological time series. But what I think is also quite important are the shorter historical time series. And sometimes I think that's value and it contains information that we're not using in the best way. Of course, if you're an hydrologist, you will look at data and you will have your regressions and actually your statistics based on historical data. But again, that's the shorter time series. If you're happy, then you probably have a time series of 100 years. But what we think is important is also the period before that, so the first 1 to 2,000 years of human mankind. And why is that important? I think just looking a little bit back at what and why I'm doing what I'm doing at the moment, I started by working as a water engineer, actually. We were looking at the water use of forest. Then in 1996, for me, a quite important event happened, and that's the Kyoto Protocol. A lot of attention was paid at that moment to the emissions of carbon dioxide, but also other greenhouses and warming of the globe. And of course, still super important. But for me, 1996 with Kyoto, that was an important starting point where global attention was being paid to this issue. Then later on, people became to realize that you will not be able to solve all the problems in time to prevent climate change to happen. So that's when in Paris and later on also in the COP in Glasgow and in Egypt, much more attention was being paid to adaptation. And I was quite happy because that meant that besides, say, carbon dioxide, also water was coming back on the agenda. And water has been outside of discussion for some part. But I do think that with the present developments where you also see the extreme events, both in too much water, but also in droughts, this is becoming a bigger and a bigger issue. And why I think that those changes are important is that what you see now is that with the New York conference on water taking place, that people start to realize that also looking at mitigation or adaptation is not enough. You have to do this together. You have to look at holistic ways how to do that. What I mean is that you're looking at interdisciplinarity, so looking at how you can engage maybe a water engineer, but also maybe with an agricultural engineer. But also what's important in these holistic ways is that you also have to think together with people that are working on the financial side, that are working on the governance side, that are working on the side where you can get data and information from those data. So that's really why you need this complex way maybe to approach a problem. And it's needed because if you don't do that, you risk actually that you create a solution that may not be a solution for all. It will be an unsustainable solution that will solve a technical issue, but it will not be a sustainable one that will help you to solve the issues that we see at the moment as our biggest challenges.
Indeed, to approach these challenges, we need solutions that taps into several disciplines. You mentioned the importance of working together. Can you elaborate more on this and maybe share your thoughts on how historical understanding and heritage awareness can be beneficial for successful cooperation?
Yes, so also in what I said before, it's quite important that you take the stakeholders on board. And why is that so important? Because it's not only about developing a solution, it's also, and maybe even more, about implementing the solution. And if you want to implement a solution, you should look at where the barriers are. And what we see is that often the barriers are not the technical barriers. I think we can do quite a lot, although we're always looking for new innovations, also on the technical side. But a large part of the barriers are more social barriers. There are barriers related to the policy that's in place, but also to the acceptance of the citizens, the people living there. And for this acceptance, it's good to understand what drives those people. And the drive of the people is coming very often from their perspectives, but also their perceptions. And their perceptions are for a large part based on cultural and heritage related issues. So I think if you understand in a better way where people are coming from, but also how the system has developed in the past based on the past developments, I think there's an important way forward. And Matteo, if I may, I think there's also another important part in there. And that is what I think is related to where we as a human being used to be influenced about and the way how we're being influenced at the moment. So in the past, you had a quite small circle of influence because you didn't have social media, you didn't have the ways of transport we have at the moment. So what you see that now we can probably get all goods that we need from everywhere on the globe. In the past, it was impossible. And this impossibility also led to the fact that as a human being, you were depending actually on your close surroundings. And those close surroundings were often bounded by what is naturally possible in there. And that's why I also think that with this urge for sustainability, it's good that we look back in the past also on people and how they were dealing actually with the surroundings that we have and what their solutions were. Because I think that if you do that, you will probably find out that a large part of what was known at that time can help you to come up with a more sustainable solution.
That's great. And I'd like to come back to the issue of perceptions you mentioned later. I'm sure that throughout your years of experience, you found many different examples that sustain your last argument about getting back to focus on managing our surrounding environment and resources. So maybe can you tell us a couple of those examples?
Yeah, I think that if you're talking about clear examples, for me, this week I've been talking with ambassadors and other representatives coming from the Panama Canal, coming from Iraq, coming from Uruguay. Of course, we have had this issue at Cape Town, but you also see it in south of Europe. You see the increase of sea level temperatures. You also see the droughts. You see people struggling with the heat. If you see that, I think you also realize that the pressure on our water resources is becoming bigger and bigger. And one of the traditional ways that we are slowly trying to re-implement, but that's not so easy to do, is water harvesting. What we're trying to look at is what can you do to collect water in your own surroundings? And maybe to make the link to what I said before, so that's very strongly actually letting you know and making you dependent also what's happening in your own environment. The issue is that we discarded that for a long time. And what you see at the moment is that has been replaced actually by having a tap in your home, by having piped water nearly everywhere. This piped water depends on water resources. And in a lot of cases, those water resources are groundwater resources. But what's happening is with a shortage of water, shortage of rain, we see that groundwater resources are depleting. So if you want to actually assure that you have water throughout the year, you should keep those groundwater resources for the more serious periods. And in the periods that you have other possibilities, then you should try to use that. That's where rainwater harvesting could play a big role. It could help actually to use the water coming on your roof, coming in your garden, in the old traditional ways of water harvesting, collecting that, using that, and then falling back on the groundwater reservoirs in the periods that you really have a water shortage, can help actually to take away the pressure and can help to assure that throughout the year, there's a better, more equal amount of water that can be used by everybody.
Before, you mentioned that these kinds of projects are often not easy to implement and to achieve. What type of setbacks can a water manager encounter when trying to develop solutions like these ones?
Yeah, I think that the biggest setbacks are sometimes also the change that you need in people. You need people to change the habit a bit. Just to suppose that you would like to start collecting water on your roof, that means that you have to take an action and that it's not only opening your tap anymore, but that you have to make sure that your roof is clean, that your water is being collected. And that makes a shift actually from something that you buy, like water from your tap, to something that you do. And I think that change is a real cultural change. That's where you need people on board. But you probably will also need the government on board, because you need policies about how you can assure that the water that is then collected through a rainwater harvesting system is also of the right quality. So as a government, you also have the obligation to assure that the health of people is not at risk. That means that you also have to initiate new policies, because often those policies about water harvesting are not there anymore.
In your blue paper article, you mentioned another shift that is required at this moment in time. That is a shift towards a less top-down and technocentric approach to water management, with short-term expectations, but not long-term planning.
No, you're right. That's a general issue that we see in the capacity development. And that is that, of course, people are aware that we need changes, that we need investments in the water sector. Unfortunately, a large part of these investments are done through infrastructural changes. And what we see is that there is development there, that people are being trained on the job while such an infrastructure is being implemented and being built. But what we think is missing in there is the part where you also have people thinking about, okay, is this the technical infrastructure that we need? Should we not think also about other things? So we think that people should also be trained actually on this more interdisciplinary holistic approach, and not only on the technical side. Let me give you an example. One of our PhD candidates finished his PhD and just won the prize on interdisciplinarity. In his PhD, he looked at the case of Mexico, and in there, there was a reservoir being built. And the reservoir was being built with all good intentions, because it was being built to solve the drinking water problem of two cities. Cities of a couple of 100,000 inhabitants there. But what they also forgot, actually, was that all the people living upstream of this reservoir were then out of water. So what came forward in this study is that by including actually the way and those citizens that were not living in the big cities, but upstreams, also in the development of other solutions, could give a solution for both. Could give a solution where you could provide water to the cities, and you could make sure that those local people were assured about water that they required. And I think that's a real nice example where, although a little bit late, but in the end they managed actually to solve the problem. So I think that was also an example that things are not fixed and lost, that you can make changes. I think it was also the case where the government of Mexico was an important player that made sure that we could make a change with this dam, and that the solution that they're looking for now is actually assuring that and the citizens and the local people are supplied with water. So I think for me, that's a really nice example on why you need this bigger view on the solutions that you're looking
for. Indeed, a great example. But taking a more general perspective, how can we guarantee the adoption of a comprehensive view? How can this broader approach to water solution help in achieving the SDGs?
What I'm thinking about from this high-level panel in New York, and what you see out of there is that's about all 17 sustainable development goals. And what you will see in the report is that besides looking at the things that we already know, like we need more drinking water, we need more sanitation, that there's also a quite large paragraph on finance. And I think that this financing part will be quite important for the infrastructural changes that we require. What I do hope is that there will also be a place for the social parts in there, so the soft parts, and not only the hard parts of this development. And there, I hope that it will help to create capacity, and it will help to also give people the possibilities to look at cultural heritage and to see how that can be of use in this development. I think with the World Water Forum coming up in Bali, I'm quite happy that the government of Indonesia and the government of Bali have decided to construct a new water museum also in Bali, because I think that is something that may help also to create awareness for the larger public, which we also need. We need larger public. We need the politicians also on board if we want to make sure that people accept the innovations, the changes that we're proposing. maybe more from the technical side. But like I said, I think it's good not only to do that from the technical side. I think those proposals should come together.
Yeah.
So it should come forward from, I think, the people that are also involved in agriculture and health and energy, and then put a proposal together on the table.
Right. We touched upon the idea that we need a cultural shift in people, and indeed museum can create awareness to achieve this shift. To link back to your previous point about the importance of considering different perceptions or values, especially the local ones, organizations like the Living Water Museum in India can be instrumental for water managers to familiarize with how people live with water in particular contexts.
Yeah, no, completely true. And I do think that for me, that's maybe also good to realize that the word museum is sometimes being thought of in different ways. For me, museum is a word that encompasses a lot of things. So it's about also existing governance systems that are there next to more physical things. They are a way of communication, dissemination in two ways. And so it's both looking forward, so looking at what you can do in the future, but also learning from the past, what has been done and what's possible, and what has been driving people in a certain region. And I think this drive is often still in people. So because this drive is there, it's an easy entry point actually to get somebody's attention. And so that's why I think it's so important to not only look through the water museums, but I think it's an end story. I think it's also always good as a water engineer to be open to the media. And so be open if a politician invites you for a discussion. Please share your thoughts, your knowledge with them so you can take them on board. Because I think that in the end is much, much better than if you have to pose a technical solution or a policy on people without having informed them and without having taken on board their thoughts and their ideas.
In this course, we propose the idea of value as conceptions of what is most desirable, according to individuals or a group. These values will then influence the selection from available modes, means, and ends of action. I think that what you are saying connects a lot with understanding what values drive people in order to create collaboration and the basis to tackle challenges together.
Yeah, I think that's really good. I only see one, risk there. You have to be quite clear what you mean by values all the time, is that often values are translated in dollars and euros. I think you should not do that because I think that's not what it is about. And so that means that it's also not an easy decision, because if you can translate it in euros or dollars, you just do a calculation and say, okay, we do that or that. But I don't think that's the way forward. I think you really should consider that those different values, like you were mentioning, you should consider each of them apart. So not only on the financial side, but also on what that means for nature, what that means for quality of life and all the other things.
Could you share your experience on how can we weight different values?
There are different tools that you can use. A more technocratic one is that you give weight to different important things, and you decide together on where the biggest weight is. And that's, I think, sometimes a nice starting point, because that can give a direction, but I don't think you should keep that as the final one. I think you should use it as an opening and an introduction to group discussion, where you really sit together to try to better understand the pros and the cons of those different values. And I know it's not an easy one. Sometimes you could also use a serious game to get a better understanding of those values. And I think sometimes it's also good to think or learn a little bit from what you see happening in the more diplomatic exchange, where people also sit together and have to make a decision and have to start appreciating one another's values, but also one another's problems. And in the end, to come up with a treaty that both parties accept. And I think that there's still things to learn. And I also know that those are not easy, but I do think that there are tools like that that can be used in such negotiations that you will have to do when you start looking at those different values.
Indeed. Thank you, Eddie. My last question is, how do you decide who to integrate in the conversation? How do you choose who are the relevant stakeholders?
One of my own unsolved discussions is the definition of stakeholder. for me, that's really difficult. Just to give you one example, a couple of years ago, you know, the island of Texel here. And this is a little bit of an extreme example, but what happened there is a discussion about how to further develop the island. So who is then the most important stakeholder there? Are those the people that own the harbor? Are that people with the restaurants? Are that the local inhabitants that used to have their families there for a long time and now living there mostly? Or are that the people that come there because they have or they need a two-week holiday because otherwise mentally they will not survive? So who's then the stakeholder? That's one example. Another one was San Francisco, where we worked on an area that they want to develop. Then the stakeholders there are often the owners, it's the city, and it's the project developers, but not the people that will live there later on. Sometimes it's really difficult to also get the right stakeholders on board. And in my experience, it's quite often the financial side that gets the highest priority, which is not something that you would like to have. And there, I think it would be nice if you could place this financial priority actually in the future, because I think it will change if you take the future values there. And then maybe even on the financial side, you could take another decision.
Yes. So not to prioritize shortcoming profit, but creating solutions that can become profitable in the future, but that creates added value for the territory from the very beginning.
Yes.
And that's also related to what's sometimes being called the heritage that you leave to your children and grandchildren.
Absolutely. We spoke about capacity development and the shift of perspective that we need on both sides of the water system, meaning both in the water management sector and in the people depending on the water system. We touched upon a couple of examples that integrate heritage structures and traditional practices to answer current water availability problems. And we mentioned the need for system analysis and ecosystem thinking to actually leave no one behind while implementing water solutions. So, if you were to leave a message for our learners, or a final takeaway point, what would it be?
Yeah, I think I would really appreciate if what I sometimes think is needed, and I hope that you all will also do that. And that's what I sometimes put under the term leadership. So what I hope that you also get from this course, that you develop those leadership skills and that you acquire knowledge, but you're also willing to share this knowledge with others, that you reach out in an open way to others to share this knowledge, but also that you take the responsibility to stand up and speak out about the issues that you think is important and that require attention. So I hope that by following this course and also in the future, that you will take this responsibility to become one of the water leaders in there. And I do hope that you will also look at the technical side of the issues, but also look at the social side, look at what has been done in the past and see how you can learn from others as well. And be open to other perceptions. I think that's also a quite important part in there. So I wish you all a very interesting and good career. And I hope to meet you as one of the water leaders in the future.
That was a fantastic final message. Thank you very much, Eddie.
Thank you, Matteo.